Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Aquaponics is the combination of agriculture, raising fish, and hydroponics, the soilless growing of plants that grows fish and plants together in one integrated system. The Commonwealth Charter Academy is about to open the country's largest aquaponics facility in Harrisburg. That will happen today. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Maurice Florey, CEO of Commonwealth Charter Academy. Dr. Florey, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Also joining us is Samantha Johnson, Director of Aquaponics, the Aquaponics Program at CCA. Ms. Johnson, welcome to the show.
All right. Thank you for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, this is something that I know we have a curious audience. You may have some questions about. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I had a brief definition, Samantha Johnson, of aquaponics, but maybe you can go into it a little bit more. What is aquaponics? How would you describe it?
So aquaponics is essentially using fish waste to produce some sort of usable fertilizer by plants. So in our facility, we have these very large fish tanks. We have three that are over 670 gallons. That water then gets piped into plant beds. As the fish do their thing and they produce their waste, which is essentially poop, it gets converted by different types of bacteria into that usable fertilizer. Once that fertilizer hits the plant roots, the plants take that fertilizer out, effectively cleaning that water, and then it gets cycled back into the fish tank to start the process all over again.
Now, it doesn't involve soil at all.
Nope, it's a soilless method. We have three different types of soilless agriculture that we have at our facility. We have hydroponics, aeroponics. The main one is aquaponics. The reason why we chose that is because it falls under the umbrella of sustainability. So soilless agriculture allows you to grow plants, trees, vegetables, using 90 to 95% less water than traditional agriculture.
Mm-hmm. So as I said in the introduction, and you just mentioned that it is the combination of hydroponics and aquaponics. But what is aeroponics? And it's A-E-R-O, by the way.
Mm-hmm. So aeroponics is distinctly different because you're not using any medium to grow your plants. So with aquaponics and hydroponics, you can use rock wool, you can use air-blown clay, you can use shale. But with aeroponics, you're literally growing plants and their roots in air. You mist those roots with some sort of solution that contains micro and macronutrients, but you're not using anything to actually hold the roots.
Mm-hmm. So I guess one of the first questions I had when I learned about this was, do fish produce that much waste?
They do. So it is a living ecosystem. So everything has to have some sort of a balance. So you need so many fish to so many types of plants to so many gallons of water. So if that gets thrown out of balance, then you have too much waste or too much fertilizer. If you don't have enough, then you have too little for the plants to grow.
Hmm. So what you're opening today, the facility, which is the largest in the country, is called AgWorks. Describe the AgWorks facility.
So AgWorks at CCA is a 6,100 square foot facility. It really highlights different learning capabilities for our students. So hands-on learning and virtual learning surrounding not just agriculture, but different career options for kids. You have plumbing, you have electrical, you have lighting, you have marketing, you have communication. All of that falls under that umbrella. We are a cyber charter school. We serve over 9,200 students across the state. So along with our physical building, which has the main growth areas, we also have a tissue culture lab, a genetics lab, research and development lab. We also have a mobile classroom, a mobile trailer that has fish and plants that goes all across the state.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Florey, how did this come to be?
Well, how it came to be is when we acquired the building in Harrisburg, it had a very unique central footprint that wasn't going to lend itself to traditional office spaces. And one of our missions as a school is to prepare students for careers. You know, what do you want to do when you're 25 and 30 years old? What's your life going to be post-graduation with us? And we wanted to look at the traditional, the highest need employment sectors in Pennsylvania, which are agriculture, technology, and medicine. And the footprint of this facility in Harrisburg, and the fact we're right across from the Harrisburg Farm Show building and the Department of Agriculture, just lent itself to something in that field.
So, okay, yeah, you kind of described that if you're familiar with Harrisburg, but the physical location is actually where?
It's in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, right across the street from the Farm Show building that many people are familiar with. The Farm Show is coming up here in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. And in the Department of Agriculture building?
We're catty-cornered from the Department of Agriculture.
Has there been assistance or any kind of partnership with the State Department of Agriculture?
They have made visits. They have come and visited our facility. We've consulted with them as well as multiple universities in the area on how to put this type of a facility in. So they've been actively involved in discussions with us.
Mm-hmm. The idea, where did it come from? How did it develop?
Well, the original idea is, as we looked at the footprint of this building, and the roof looks like very similar to a greenhouse, was what do we do with this very unique, about 6,000 square foot space to look at career opportunities for our students? And we found a local company in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania called Intag that had been building smaller aquaponics and hydroponics facilities for schools, higher ed, and even worldwide in some in developing countries to help them come up with sustainable agriculture. So we reached out to them and said, let's do a large facility where it can be a combination of laboratory to look at all the different ways to grow plants without soil, as well as a production production facility so we can provide plants to local food banks and restaurants and that type of thing. So we partnered with them, and we partnered with Messiah College in the design of the facility.
Mm-hmm. And something you just mentioned, that if you are producing food, you are growing plants, and there's fish involved, that whatever is produced, that I don't know if I say whatever, that makes it sound like everything, does everything go to outside to restaurants and food banks?
Right now, that is everything that's produced within the facility is either given to a restaurant, and any excess that the restaurants can't use then goes to the Central Pennsylvania Food Bank.
So what kind of vegetables, what kind of plants are we talking about?
I'll let you speak to that, Sam, because you know the specifics. There's 3,000 plants currently in the facility, and she can speak more intelligently to the actual mix of the plants.
Mm-hmm. So we have different trees. We have avocado, we have lemon, we have a cocoa tree. Mainly what restaurants are looking for are leafy greens. We kind of joked around with the Hilton when we did a drop-off with them because of the E. coli outbreak. We have romaine lettuce growing in our facility right now.
I was going to say, you joke about E. coli often?
Well, it was one of those...
I understand what you're saying.
It was one of those, hey, we have butter lettuce and we have five-star lettuce that we're dropping off. And their head chef went, ha-ha, don't you have any romaine? And I went, we do, but I didn't think that you would want any because most people that are purchasing aren't going to order something that has romaine lettuce in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, their eyes lit up and they went, please bring us some romaine. But we're growing...
And it ended up coming from California anyway, the romaine that had the problems, right?
Yeah. And so we have all sorts of tomatoes. We have different varieties of tomatoes. We have eggplants that we're growing in there. We have squash. We have zucchini. But primarily what restaurants are looking for are different varieties of lettuce and basil.
Mm-hmm. What about the fish?
Right now, we're using tilapia and koi as the main drivers of our system. We chose them because they are a very resilient fish. They eat a lot of food and they produce a lot of waste, so they're perfect for our system. We are going to be piloting prawn here in the next few weeks.
I have to admit that one of the questions I had when I was preparing for this is there one species of fish that produces more waste than others?
And there are. There's a
should
pretty,
know that, yeah.
And there's a pretty wide variety. We could use something like sturgeon or channel catfish. They're considered your quote-unquote dirty fish because
right,
they do
right.
produce so much waste. We chose koi because generally they're very pretty. And when we go to sell them, when our students go to sell them, they can sell them to landscaping companies. Whereas tilapia is a different learning experience for them because they would be selling those to restaurants.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the students. And Dr. Flory, jump in here too. As you said, the Commonwealth Charter Academy has 9,200 students across the state, K through 12. But as a cyber school, how are students that, and because you know, I have to admit that when I thought of cyber school, I'm thinking, okay, you're at home, the student is at home next to a computer screen. How are students that are at a cyber charter school able to use this?
Well, the entire system, every plant bed, every growing rack has sensors in it that are monitored through a web-based system. So a student could be in Erie, Pennsylvania or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and they could be collaborating on a light signature or nutrient levels that they could be tracking an individual plant bed. So it's all virtually and remotely accessible to our students. Plus, we have the mobile unit that can go around to certain neighborhoods so they can go see hand-on, you know, how you harvest, how you plant. So it's very important to us to make it accessible to every single student that wants to be part of it.
But someone, a human, has to physically put those plants there. I was about to say plant those plants. Is that the accurate way to describe that?
Yeah, that's correct. All the plants we base off of seed, except for a few of our trees that we bought small tree stock, it all starts as seed. And students actually do that individual seeding before we put it into the larger plant beds.
So AgWorks opens today. What does opens mean? Because it sounds like, if these plants are growing now, that someone had to plant them before you open, obviously.
Yeah, the grand opening could be, you know, called a ribbon cutting. It's going to be an initial large-scale harvest. We've been growing the facility for several months to try to get it to some level of maturity. And we wanted to save the ribbon cutting till people could see every different mechanism, every different type of growing and kind of full flower, so to speak, no pun intended, so they actually visually can see how all the different growing techniques work.
Mm-hmm. Students working in there already? Because I have seen photographs, and I know you have a video. By the way, if you'd like to see, get an idea of what we're talking about, on our website, WITF.org, we have a link so that there are some photographs, and you can see pictures, and there's also a video. But students are already working in there, correct?
They are. So we got the word out very gently to some of our students that are in the local area and invited them to come in and take part through an independent study course. It's a student-run lab, so we needed to train that first crop of students to be able to learn how to seed, how to propagate, how to harvest, all of the food science that goes in behind that, making sure that they're following cleanliness standards. Now that we're having the grand opening, we can open it up to the rest of our students, and we now have a crop that can train the new ones that are coming into the facility.
How do you harvest? Is it any differently than traditional farming methods?
It is, because you are using fish waste that are kind of traveling through each one of these beds. Our students know that when they're using their shears, they sanitize their shears. And when they do cuttings, they want to make sure they don't touch any of the rock or any of the water, because they have to go back then and re-sanitize. So it's very similar, except that in our lab, we're tracking all of the data on everything we're growing. So not only are students doing those cuttings and bagging that lettuce, bagging that basil, but they also have to weigh it out. That way we can see, okay, this is how much we can grow, this is how quickly we can grow it. So when our students are going and developing that business strategy, they know how much they can guarantee to Hilton or Harvest or Black and Blue, how much we can guarantee them every week.
Yeah, one of the key elements of this facility is it's a research facility. And so our students are able to manipulate light on these plants. And so part of what we feel we owe the industry is through our research to be able to go to the commercial producers and say, we discovered that with this type of basil, if this is the light recipe you use on this type of basil, you can get this much more production. And so our students have to monitor every single growing rack, every single plant, every single bed very accurately so we can help to inform the industry.
A couple questions. When you say the industry, what industry are you talking about?
Well, there are some commercial aquaponics and hydroponics facilities out there. So we help them. We can provide information to them to help them turn out a more profitable business.
Mm-hmm. And the other question I thought of a few minutes ago is when you were developing AgWorks and you said you wanted it to be larger than some of the smaller ones around the area, was the goal to build the largest in the country?
No, it's just that the footprint made it the largest. Our goal was to build a facility large enough that we could put professional laboratories in the facility to give K-12 students a professional laboratory experience, not just a pretend laboratory experience. We wanted them to have a facility that was really state-of-the-art so that if they go to college, if they go into the industry right out of high school, they're going to have all the requisite skills necessary to perform in that business.
Skills for what? I mean, what kind of skills?
Well, you can talk about that, Sam, some of the intricate details that we're teaching within some of the laboratory experiences.
Mm-hmm. There's some misconceptions out there about what it's like to be a scientist. A lot of students think, well, I want to be a biologist. I need to go to college right out of school. our school in particular, we have a high instance of students that are economically disadvantaged. So when they meet with me, they go, this is all well and good, but I'm not really going to be able to work in these labs. I'm not planning to go to college. So it's up to me to really explain to them, you know, if you can learn basic lab etiquette skills, you know, you want to sanitize your area, you don't want to interfere with someone else's work area, you want to be quiet, you want to clean up after yourself, those sort of things, or even simple things like how to pipette, how to track what you're using, how to alert your supervisor when you're starting to run out of product. All of those things are basic lab skills. And students in college, they suffer with that. We've heard that from college professors that they really struggle with that because they're not gaining that in high school. But then when you're going to work in an actual lab, you can get an entry-level job at a lab without having to go to college. Those labs, if you do a good job, they will invest back in you and send you to college. So for students, it's really kind of trying to explain to them, if you have a passion in this area and you want to go to college, you don't necessarily have to, but if you want to, but you can't afford it, these are some avenues that you can take for success.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about a new facility that will open today, Commonwealth Charter Academy's AgWorks in Harrisburg. It's right next to the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture, and it's an aquaponics facility, the largest in the country. And if you're not familiar with the term, it means raising fish or other, in some cases, animals, or I should say aqua life, aquatic life, and using the waste for a soilless growing of plants. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Our guest today, Dr. Maurice Flory, CEO of Commonwealth Charter Academy, and Samantha Johnson, Director of the Aquaponics Program at CCA. 1-800-729-7532. We have an email here from Cindy, who says, the basis of our life on this planet is soil. These artificial methods of growing plants waste energy, create plastic debris, and take education away from the important study of soil. She also adds that our Native Americans knew how to use fish. They buried one in the soil at the base of plants. So Cindy does not sound like she's a big fan of aquaponics.
Well, I think this aquaponics facility and soilless growing is never going to replace traditional agriculture. It just isn't. For several decades, it's not going to do that. But one of the problems we have in multiple environments, especially in our urban environments, is lack of enough square footage or acreage to produce fresh fruits, fresh vegetables for those people in those communities. So with many of the abandoned structures we have, especially from abandoned manufacturing facilities or large indoor facilities, hydroponics, aquaponics may be an option for some of those communities where traditional methods of agriculture may not be. Some soils in some countries are also so deficient, they support very, very limited types of agriculture. This may also be a benefit to some of those types of communities.
So you're not anti-soil?
Oh, absolutely not.
I never thought I'd ask that question. Yeah, I'm not anti-soil.
I'm a central Pennsylvania boy that grew up on 170-acre traditional farm, so I'm absolutely not traditional farming methods. I'm not against them.
Other point she makes, though, about plastic debris. Does it produce plastic debris?
In our facility, it's zero waste. There's no waste. It's a closed circuit facility. There's actually no plastics involved in the facility outside the fish tanks and the beds that hold the plants.
Yeah, the only item that we have that we currently use are clamshells that we take to local restaurants. All of that is biodegradable and compostable. We were very thorough when trying to plan a sustainable environment. And it's important for our students to know, hey, when you take something out of here, you don't want to use Tupperware or something like that that can't be recycled. So we were very purposeful in getting things from Pure Goods to make sure that everything that everyone takes home with them, you can recycle or even compost.
I saw that you also are using solar power for some of your energy.
Yeah, a third-party company came to us with interest in, because it's a large roof in the building, about installing solar panels to use as, you know, to supply energy to the building. And so we entered in an agreement with them for that grant, solar panels on the roof of the building that fully powers the aquaponics facility with excess that helps offset about a third of the energy cost in the whole building.
Mm-hmm. Did you consider a green roof?
We're going to put a small green roof in on just a segment of the facility, but the current structure of the roof didn't support a green-type facility.
Let's take a phone call from Janice in Myerstown. Janice, you're on the air.
My problem is trying to understand how hydroponics work, because if you have a plant in ground and there's too much water, the roots will rot. But in hydroponics, the roots are in water all the time. Please explain.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, and she makes a good point.
So in our facility, we use both a water that cycles through that's mixed with macro and micronutrients. We're very sanitary in our facility, so we very much limit the amount of outside pests that come in, so you don't have a lot of fungus that come in, you don't have a lot of mold, because it's constantly, that water's constantly flowing. There's not a lot of pests also in our system because we don't use a lot of soil. Sometimes those roots tend to rot because other microbes work their way in from the soil. Without soil, you reduce your instance of microbes, you use less pesticides, less herbicides, and so it really helps to promote the healthiest possible plant in the best type of environment for their growth.
So it is different then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because what you describe, we probably all, even if it's a house plant, mm-hmm. have experienced that with too much water where the plant roots rot.
Yeah, a lot of times when you overwater a plant and that water just tends to sit in there, that's when you might get fruit flies and things that
right.
come into your home. All of that breeds in the soil. Everything that breeds in the soil starts to take away those nutrients out of the soil, leaving less and less for that plant to take up, meaning it's just sitting in water that's slowly becoming polluted with excess waste. That usually is what causes those roots to slowly rot out.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Wilson in Harrisburg. Wilson, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
This morning.
Doing well.
Good. I have just retired, and I have been interested in aquaponics for several years, more than seven, I'd say. Are there any opportunities for volunteers at this facility?
Thank you for your call, Wilson.
Well, one of the things I know Sam will piggyback onto this, that the facility is open to the public. Anybody from the community that wants to come in and tour, we can arrange tours to take any group through. It's also open to any school-age children, families, field trips, Cub Scout groups, you know, any type of group is open. So certainly you're welcome to come in and tour, and Sam can speak to some of the opportunities for volunteers within the facility.
So currently we do have one adult volunteer. He found out about the system through word of mouth. You are working with students, so you do have to pass your clearances. But just like you described, this individual was really interested in learning a lot more about how to run something like this. We've had a few other people that are interested as well. You would just go to our website. You'd start out by scheduling a tour. I would provide the tour, and I can talk with people in more depth about how to get involved.
All right, so let's talk about how this was paid for. How was it paid for?
It was through a federal grant. The entire building of the aquaponics facility was paid through by a federal grant that we secured as a school.
So as a charter school, you are a public school, correct?
Correct.
Okay. There may be other public schools out there who would say, you know what, we can't afford something like this, but a charter school can.
Well, my comment would be they could, because the grant that we secured is available to every public school. We just chose to apply for the grant and use it to build this facility. We could have applied for the grant and used it to pay for salaries or to do another type of curricular program. We chose to build this career-based facility.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to get into the whole how charter schools are paid for and then where you get your funding and all that, but to a degree, you are getting some money from public schools, from taxpayers, correct?
Correct. That's why it's our mission to make sure that this facility is open to the general public. Public tax dollars paid for our building. They pay to run our program. Revenue flows to us from school districts. So it's only appropriate that we make this facility available to all schools that would want to take part in using it.
Okay. Now, when you say all schools that want to take part in using it, I just want to make sure and clarify that. Does that mean that a student attending, say, Harrisburg High School or Central Dauphin High School, or if it's, since it's K through 12, one of the elementary schools, that they could actually work in the facility?
Absolutely. If they're interested, we would be able to accommodate them if they would like to do lab work or harvesting, whatever, however they would like to take part in the facility. And if they're not one of our students, we would welcome them in.
Would they get credit in their own school districts then, some class credit?
We would be more than willing to work with that school district to keep good records of what functions they're performing within the facility, if that other school would like to award credit, we'd be more than willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. I had a call from Joe in Dallastown who asked, what's the difference between farm-raised fish? Let me say that again. What is the difference between farm-raised fish and the process the guests are using? Define fish farms.
So overall, what makes this type of growing so successful is when you're doing traditional fish farming, you can set up a fish farm in a multitude of different ways. Sometimes it gets a bad name. Tilapia in particular, we chose that not only because it does produce a lot of waste, but we chose it because it's a farmable fish, meaning it can be raised in South Carolina, it could be raised in China, and then typically when it gets sent to us to be eaten, it's frozen. Because it tends to be a little bit dirtier of a fish, it produces a lot of waste. That can mess with the pH. And sometimes if you're not a very good fish farmer, it's not really living in its best environment. Whereas with aquaponics, you need to make sure your fish are happy. If they're not happy, then they don't eat. If they don't eat, they don't produce waste. So in this type of a setting, you're actually ensuring that everything is just right for those fish and that they're perfectly happy. The pH is right. Your nitrates are right. Your ammonia is low. Whereas in traditional farming for fish, you don't really have to worry about that. You're just worrying about getting your fish to grow as fast as possible, as quickly as possible.
You don't try to get the fish to, and this is a question, do you try to get the fish to grow faster than what they should?
No, and we follow traditional practices with how much we feed our fish. We don't ever overfeed our fish. If anything, we monitor that very closely, because if you do overfeed, that starts to break down in the water. We actually have two students that are building me an auto feeder. That way I don't have to come in every weekend and over holidays. That's an example of how our students can remotely contribute to the lab. But we have to monitor that very carefully because we don't want to overfeed our fish.
Yeah, how I explain the fish is you have to treat the fish like an engine. They need to be tuned up for maximal performance. You can't give them too much fuel or too little fuel. They're the engine that makes the system run, and you have to treat them accordingly.
You know, forgive me for talking about fish waste, but since you brought it up, are there certain foods that you feed them that produce more waste? I mean, greasy foods, you know, something like that. I'm joking.
Well, we recognize that the consumer wants certain things out of their product. For fish, we make sure that our engine is well oiled, so we use all GMO-free pellets when we go to feed our fish. You could technically feed them leaves and other things that are fully sustainable from the system, but we went the GMO-free route. And then again, no pesticides within the system, offering that organic alternative option for families that truly care about where their food is sourced from.
Yeah. I want to thank the two of you for being with us today, and I'm sure that this has piqued the curiosity of a lot of our listeners today. Can the public attend your, it's not ribbon cutting so much as grand opening?
Well, the grand opening is actually going to be within the hour, as that's going to be launched. So it would probably be difficult for the general public to attend that, but other than that, they're welcome at any time. Just call us and we can arrange a tour.
I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Maurice Flory, CEO of Commonwealth Charter Academy, and Samantha Johnson, Director of the Aquaponics Program at CCA. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, expanding broadband internet access in Pennsylvania. That's coming up on tomorrow's show. More than 5,400 people died of drug overdoses in Pennsylvania last year. Most of them were killed by overdosing on opioids. A project instituted by the state, Stop Overdoses in PA, Get Help Now Week, a statewide initiative to distribute naloxone and get help for residents suffering from the disease of opioid use disorder, is going on right now. Naloxone, the overdose reversal drug, will be handed out at 80 locations around the state this Thursday, the day after tomorrow. Joining us on today's program to talk about this is Dr. Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania Secretary of Health. Dr. Levine, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also joining us is Ellen D. Domenico, who is Deputy Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. Deputy Secretary, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, call 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, what is Stop Overdoses in Pennsylvania Get Help Now Week designed to do?
So the purpose of this initiative is to expand our distribution of the life-saving medicine naloxone to our communities throughout the Commonwealth, and to have really almost everyone be a first responder and have the ability to have this life-saving medication in order to save someone's life from an opioid overdose.
But it is a week. This is a week-long initiative. So on Thursday, as I mentioned, 80 different locations around the state. There has to be more to the week than just the free naloxone on Thursday.
So what we've been doing throughout the week is the governor yesterday and many members of the cabinet and the administration are having media events and public events to highlight the importance of this aspect of the response to the opioid crisis, to save a life with the medication naloxone. Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit more about that. Free naloxone, where did the idea come from and what do you hope to achieve with it?
Sure. So this is really integral part of our whole administration's response under Governor Wolf's leadership to the opioid crisis. As you know, the governor has declared a disaster declaration in January, those last 90 days. So we're currently in our fourth iteration of the disaster declaration. And that brings us all together under a command center structure at the Pennsylvania Emergency Management Association to deal with this crisis. We have three pillars of our response: prevention, rescue, and that's the medication naloxone, and then getting people into treatment. And so what we're trying to do is to emphasize this rescue aspect so that the public will have access to this medication to save lives.
Mm-hmm. So Ellen DiDomenico, one of the keys to, naloxone we know saves lives when someone has overdosed from an opioid. Unfortunately, we've heard too many stories about those who have overdosed and then overdose again and overdose again because they don't seek treatment. The state has had a plan, what you've called a warm handoff.
Absolutely.
For treatment. But what can be done, and is that part of this, if someone, is given a dose of naloxone and to get them into treatment so that they won't need it again?
Absolutely. There's a whole range of things that we're doing as a part of post-rescue. So the rescue is a really critical piece in terms of this intervention, because if the person isn't surviving, we don't have hope of doing anything more in terms of getting them to the appropriate treatment places and to start them on their road to recovery. So a part of what the rescue does then is to give us that opportunity. And so we're building all kinds of pathways from that rescue. So we know at this point that when the emergency responders are in the field, about 91% of the individuals are willing to go to the emergency room for the follow-up. There's a lot of myths out there that says people don't want to. They're rescued and then they say, let me go. I don't want to go to the hospital. We know that's not true. The rescue workers have been doing great work in terms of convincing people that the next step for them is to go to the emergency room. And then from those emergency rooms all across the Commonwealth, building pathways to treatment. So having individuals available right there in the emergency room. And some of our counties have really begun to show incredible results in terms of how many people that they speak with and provide some support to in the emergency room actually go on into treatment. So our numbers are improving all the time. We're not where we want to be, but we're really building those pathways that'll get us to a better place.
Do we have any statistics, any even anecdotal stories about the percentage of people who have overdosed who then go on to treatment?
So as the Deputy Secretary was saying, over 90% of individuals that are revived by EMS are brought to the emergency department. And then there are some statistics, as she mentioned, with specific counties that are getting two-thirds or more individuals that are in the emergency department successfully engaged in treatment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. And again, we're seeing that growing all the time. This is a work in progress. I mean, this has been a huge epidemic in the whole United States, and Pennsylvania certainly hasn't been immune to that. So as we continue to work at the local level with hitting a variety of different ways of getting people to treatment, you know, we have our helpline that folks call. And again, you know, we've passed the 35,000 mark in terms of how many calls we've had to that. And about 45% of those folks are actually being transitioned virtually at that point in time to someone to help them with treatment. So it's not that they're just calling and talking a little bit and then hanging up. They're actually being given a virtual warm handoff towards treatment. So again, building all kinds of pathways to get people at the right place at the right time for the right treatment.
And by the way, and this is an important part to mention, that there is a website through the Department of Health that has a lot of information. It's related to the Stop Overdoses and PED. Get Help Now Week, that has phone numbers to call, has resources for those who want to seek treatment. What is that website?
So there are a number of different websites. Really, what we're directing people to is the Pennsylvania Opioid Data Dashboard, and that has information about the three pillars. It has prevention information, it has rescue information, it has treatment information about all the different treatment centers, and of course, it has the number for the helpline.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, we have a link to one of those websites at our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. When you see the description of today's program, we have a link to the website. But there's a lot of good information on there. What does a dose of naloxone cost?
So there are a number of different forms of naloxone that were covered under the standing order that I wrote in 2015. Predominantly, there's nasal naloxone that's given intranasally, and then there is an auto-injector, although that's much more expensive. So the type that we are handing out on the 13th and that we have been distributing regularly is the nasal naloxone. And then we'll also be handing out information about how to get trained, about how to use it, and even a card that explains how to use it. It's a nasal spray. It's very simple to use.
But how much does it cost?
So for that product, if you were going to buy it cash, would be approximately $120 for a kit of two. Now, remember, people can go to any pharmacy, really at any time, and obtain this medication through my standing order prescription, and it's covered by Medicaid, it's covered by CHIP, it's covered by Medicare, and it's covered by all commercial insurance companies. But to make sure that the public has ready access to it, we're having the Naloxone Day on December 13th.
So it is free to those who take it. I guess my next question is, you know, how many doses are we talking about on Thursday?
Sure.
And who's paying for that?
So there will be 5,000 doses available throughout the state at 80 locations, as you mentioned. And so the money that's covering this distribution of naloxone, as well as the naloxone that we distribute to first responders, such as police and EMS, is coming from $5 million that the governor obtained from the legislature for naloxone in the 2017-2018 budget.
Mm. Ellen DiDomenico, let me just follow up with a question there with as far as naloxone itself. You know, there are people who would say that, you know, one of the reasons that I shouldn't say, I don't know if there's anyone out there that I've ever met who has said, don't hand out naloxone, but there are those who have said, aren't you promoting the use? There are some people that will continue to use because they have this available. They look at it and say, oh, I can save myself if I OD.
Well, I'm sure there are folks that say that, but that's not what we find to be the general experience of folks out in the field. I mean, these are individuals who have an illness. They are addicted to opioids. The illness results in pretty tragic circumstances in some instances. And just like any other medical condition, we want to keep treating that medical condition until we get the person to a point of recovery. You know, we don't view it any differently than someone who has had multiple heart attacks. We would never suggest that someone should not be resuscitated from multiple heart attacks. There is a part of this disease, just like other medical conditions, that it is a lifelong condition. And so we want to be able to provide treatment at the right place at the right time. And if that means that somebody has overdosed previously, this may be the time where they are ready and at a point in their life and have the right motivation and the right supports from other people around them to get into treatment and start their own road to recovery.
And for our audience, don't take this as pushing back or discouraging people from taking advantage of this, because obviously it is a true lifesaver and it is one step on the road to recovery and in fighting this opioid crisis. But there is a but here. When this was announced, I think last week, I saw a couple comments in social media saying, I don't know how I feel about this, because I'm all for saving lives for those who are suffering from opioid addiction. But what about those who are, say, type 1 diabetes sufferers who, you know, are having trouble? NPR just did a story yesterday about the price of insulin that has just skyrocketed, and there are so many type 1 diabetes patients who are having trouble affording insulin. And that's just one example. But what do you say to people like that?
Well, it's very important, of course, that we work to make sure that everybody has access to quality health insurance and health coverage that can help them prevent illnesses, but also help them treat illnesses that they had. Really, one of the biggest things that the governor did to improve health care in Pennsylvania, including addressing the opioid crisis, is expand Medicaid. And so under the Affordable Care Act, right as soon as he was inaugurated, the governor expanded Medicaid, which meant that that's over 700,000 people in Pennsylvania had access to quality health insurance that would pay for absolutely life-saving necessary medicines such as insulin. And then, of course, that includes over 120,000 individuals that have accessed quality substance use disorder treatment, like opioid use disorder, with the expansion of Medicaid. We have really one of the lowest uninsured rates in the country, and really one of the lowest uninsured rates that's ever been in Pennsylvania. We want to make sure that everybody has access to health insurance to help them with their medical problems.
But for those who don't qualify for Medicaid, I mean, a lot of them are still paying, even if their insurance company is paying for a lot of it, are paying those prices that, I mean, that's a whole separate issue as to why the insulin has increased by the price that it has.
Well, we would certainly be in favor of people having access to the life-saving medicine that they need. And yes, that's a whole separate issue in terms of the pricing of necessary drugs in our country. But focusing back on the opioid crisis, as you mentioned, you know, over 5,400 individuals died of overdoses in 2017. This is really one of the biggest public health crises that we have faced in Pennsylvania and throughout the nation. I've just come from some national meetings, and really the federal government is providing robust funding and technical advice. We work with other states. And so the Wolf administration is committed to addressing this public health crisis that's in our midst.
If you have a question or a comment, our guest today, Dr. Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Ellen DiDomenico, who is Deputy Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. We are in the midst of Stop Overdoses in PA. Is it PA or Pennsylvania?
Either one.
Okay. I just saw PA, and often.
But it represents our Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
All right. Stop Overdoses in Pennsylvania. Get Help Now week. We're talking about it Thursday in particular, where naloxone will be handed out free at 80 locations across the state. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. For more on the opioid crisis, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I saw a press release from your office, Secretary Levine, yesterday that said you're making revisions to prescribing painkiller guidelines, and it's part of this week, this initiative. What kind of changes are you making?
Sure. So remember, one of the pillars that we have in terms of our addressing the opioid crisis is prevention. And one of the most important aspects of that is working with the medical community to learn to use, to prescribe these powerful medicines much more carefully and judiciously. And so we have actually 11 prescribing guidelines for physicians and other prescribers about how to use these medicines really carefully. And so these include pediatric guidelines, geriatric guidelines, chronic non-cancer pain guidelines. And so these were emergency department guidelines that were written actually in 2015, and medical progress changes. And so we have revised those guidelines for emergency medicine physicians in terms of using opioids.
Mm. Big changes? I mean, because if they're big changes, it would seem that that could have even more of an impact, or as much of an impact, as the free naloxone.
I wouldn't say that they were dramatically big changes, but they are. We have made the guidelines consistent with other states and other federal recommendations. Overall, what we want people, what physicians to do is to prescribe opioids only when really necessary for severe pain. There are a number of different studies that show that for very mild to moderate pain, that actually over-the-counter medicines work as well, if not better. And we want physicians to use the lowest dose for the shortest period of time so that patients don't get potentially dependent or addicted to these medicines.
I want to talk a little bit about fentanyl before we take some phone calls. Of those 5,400 people plus who died of overdoses in 2017. I understand that two-thirds of them, that fentanyl was involved. Now, fentanyl is a painkiller. Unfortunately, what's happened is that many of the people who are selling heroin, for example, that it is laced with fentanyl, which is at least 100 times more powerful than heroin. First of all, does naloxone work to reverse an overdose on fentanyl?
So, yes. So, fentanyl, as you mentioned, is a very powerful opioid. This is not diverted medicine. This is actually fentanyl analog, synthetic fentanyl that's produced primarily in China and then brought up through Central and South America through the cartels. It can also be sent, actually ordered on the dark web and sent through the mail. So it's a very powerful opioid. As you mentioned, it can be 100 times more powerful than morphine, 50 times more powerful than heroin. Naloxone will work, although frequently you might need multiple doses. And that's one reason why the kits that we are handing out have two doses of naloxone. And I just want to emphasize that if the public uses naloxone, you don't give naloxone and go back to bed. You have to call 911 immediately, and then the patient has to be brought to the emergency department first for further medical care, and then the warm handoff that Ellen was talking about.
And something that what you're doing when you're handing out this dose of naloxone, someone has to administer it, and for the most part, it's probably not a medical professional. How will that person know whether the person who is overdosing, whether there's fentanyl involved or not?
So you often don't know what's in the drug that the person took. One of the advantages of naloxone is that it has no side effects. You can't get high from it, and you can't get addicted to it. And so it's always worth thinking that the person might have overdosed if they're unconscious and administering the medication. And if the patient doesn't wake up, you administer another dose of the medication. At the same time, you or someone else is calling 911 so that EMS can come as soon as possible to revive the patient.
Let's try to get a phone call in here. Janet is in Waynesboro. Janet, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm not knocking the program. I'm just making a comment that I feel as though a lot of times the reason for this epidemic is because we have an epidemic of depression in this country, especially with young people. I have recently had a family member, a young adult, who's had been diagnosed with depression, and the state of treatment for that is an abomination. It's hard to see a psychiatrist. It's hard to see a psychologist. They're prescribed to talk to a psychologist once or twice a week, and you can get in once every other week if you're lucky. I mean, I throw my hands up, and sure, you can resuscitate all these people with that medication and hand them off, but then it's expensive and hard to get treatment for depression, and I think that's the basic problem with this opioid crisis is because we've got so many people depressed.
Janet, I hate to cut you off, but we're almost out of time, and I hope that your family member is able to get that treatment and recover from that. Point that she makes is an important one.
Yeah, absolutely. We do know that a lot of substance use disorder and mental health issues exist at the same time. There really isn't evidence that says one comes before the other, that there may be similar causation to both of those. And so I think it's really important as we think about continuing to build the treatment paradigms here in Pennsylvania, that we also are looking at the opportunities to do treatment for both of those conditions.
We are out of time for this portion of the program, a very important program, I think. And with the few seconds we have to Dr. Levine, what kind of advice would you give people who want to take advantage of this on Thursday?
Well, we want people to go to one of the 80 locations throughout the state and get naloxone so they can potentially save a life.
And we have a link on our website, WITF.org, and you can learn more about it. Dr. Rachel Levine, Pennsylvania Secretary of Health, Ellen D. Domenico, Deputy Secretary, Pennsylvania Department of Drug and Alcohol Programs. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.